off the supposed masterwork of his creative empire. Now, 2 bad hours after leaving Washington National, things had suddenly gotten a lot worse, and with shocking suddenness. The runway lights had gone out, but Dees now saw that wasn't all that had gone out. Half of Wilmington and all of Wrightsville Beach were also dark. ILS was still there, but when Dees snatched the mic and screamed, "What happened? Talk to me, Wilmington!" he got nothing back but a screech of static, in which a few voices babbled like distant ghosts. He jammed the mic back, missing the prong. It thudded to the cockpit floor at the end of its curled wire, and Dees forgot it. The grab and the yell had been pure pilot's instinct and no more. He knew what had happened, as surely as he knew the sun set in the west, which it would do very soon now. A stroke of lightning must have scored a direct hit on a power substation near the airport. The question was whether or not to go in anyway. "You had clearance," one voice said. Another immediately and correctly replied that that was so much bullshit rationalization. You learned what you were supposed to do in a situation like this when you were still the equivalent of a student driver. Logic and the book tell you to head for your alternate and try to contact ATC. Landing under snafu conditions such as these could cost him a violation and a hefty fine. On the other hand, not landing now, right now, could lose him the night flyer. It might also cost a life or lives, but Dees barely factored this into the equation, until an idea went off like a flashbulb in his mind, an inspiration that occurred, as most of his inspirations did, in huge tabloid type. Heroic reporter saves, fill in a number, as large as possible, which was pretty large given the amazingly generous borders that mark the range of human credulity, from crazed night flyer. Eat that, Farmer John, Dees thought, and continued his descent toward runway 34. The runway lights down there suddenly flashed on, as if approving his decision, then went out again, leaving blue after images on his retinas that turned the sick green of spoiled avocados a moment later. Then the weird static coming from the radio cleared, and Farmer John's voice screamed, "Haul port, N471B! Piedmont, haul starboard! Jesus, oh Jesus, midair! I think we got a midair!" Dees's self-preservation instincts were every bit as well honed as those which smelled blood in the bush. He never even saw the Piedmont Airlines 727 strobe lights. He was too busy banking as tightly to port as the beach could bank, which was as tight as a virgin's coos, and Dees would be happy to testify to that fact if he got out of this shitstorm alive as soon as the second word was out of Farmer John's mouth. He had a momentary sight sense of something huge only inches above him, and then the Beach 55 was taking a beating that made the previous rough air seem like glass. His cigarettes flew out of his breast pocket and streamed everywhere. The half-dark Wilmington skyline tilted crazily. His stomach seemed to be trying to squeeze his heart all the way up his throat and into his mouth. Spit ran up one cheek like a kid whizzing along a greased slide. Maps flew like birds. The air outside now raved with jet thunder as well as the kind nature made. One of the windows in the four-seat passenger compartment imploded, and an asthmatic wind whooped in, skirling everything not tied down back there into a tornado.
"Resume your previous altitude assignment, N471B!"
Farmer John was screaming. Dees was aware that he'd just ruined a $200 pair of pants by spraying about a pint of hot piss into them, but he was partially soothed by a strong feeling that old Farmer John had just loaded his jockey shorts with a truckload or so of fresh Mars bars. Sounded that way anyhow. Dees carried a Swiss Army knife. He took it from his right pants pocket, and holding the wheel with his left hand, cut through his shirt just above the left elbow, bringing blood. Then, with no pause, he made another cut, shallow, just below his left eye. He folded the knife shut and stuffed it into the elasticized map pocket in the pilot's door. Gotta clean it later, he thought. And if I forget it, I could be in deep shit. But he knew he wouldn't forget, and considering the things the night flyer had gotten away with, he thought he'd be okay. The runway lights came on again, this time for good, he hoped, although their pulsing quality told him they were being powered by a generator. He homed the beach in again on runway 3-4. Blood ran down his left cheek to the corner of his mouth. He sucked some in and then spat a pink mixture of blood and spit onto his IVSI. Never miss a trick. Just keep following those instincts and they'd always take you home. He looked at his watch. Sunset was only 14 minutes away now. This was cutting it much too close to the bone.
Pull up, Beach! Farmer John yelled. Are you deaf?
Dees groped for the mic's kinked wire without ever taking his eyes from the runway lights. He pulled the wire through his fingers until he got the mic itself. He palmed it and depressed the send button. Listen to me, you chicken-fried son of a bitch, he said, and now his lips were pulled all the way back to the gum line. I missed getting turned into strawberry jam by that 727 because your shit Jenny didn't kick in when it was supposed to. As a result, I had no ATC comm. I don't know how many people on the airliner just missed getting turned into strawberry jam, but I bet you do. And I know the cockpit crew does. The only reason those guys are still alive is because the captain of that boat was bright enough to Alaman Wright, and I was bright enough to Do-Si-Do. But I have sustained both structural and physical damage. If you don't give me a landing clearance right now, I'm going to land anyway. The only difference is that if I have to land without clearance, I'm going to have you up in front of an FAA hearing. But first, I will personally see to it that your head and your asshole change places. Have you got that, hoss? A long, static-filled silence. Then a very small voice, utterly unlike Farmer John's previous hearty, "Hey, Bo!" delivery, said, "You're clear to land runway 3-4 and 471B. Dees smiled and homed in on the runway. He depressed the mic button and said, "I got mean and yelling, I'm sorry. It only happens when I almost die." No response from the ground. "Well, fuck you very much," Dees said, and then headed on down, resisting the impulse to take a quick glance at his watch as he did so. Dees was case-hardened and proud of it. But there was no use kidding himself. What he found in Duffery gave him the creeps. The night flyer's Cessna had spent another entire day, July 31st, on the ramp, but that was really only where the creeps began. It was the blood, his loyal Inside View readers would care about, of course, and that was just as it should be, world without end, amen, amen. But Dees was increasingly aware that blood, or in the case of good old Ray and Ellen Sarch, the lack of blood, was only where this story started. Below the blood were caverns dark and strange. Dees arrived in Duffery on August 8th, by then barely a week behind the night flyer. He wondered again where his batty buddy went between strikes. Disney World? Busch Gardens? Atlanta, maybe, to check out the Braves? Such things were relatively small potatoes right now, with the chase still on, but they would be valuable later on. They would become, in fact, the journalistic equivalent of Hamburger Helper, stretching the leftovers of the Night Flyer story through a few more issues, allowing readers to re-savor the flavor, even after the biggest chunks of raw meat had been digested. Still, there were caverns in this story, dark places into which a man might drop and be lost forever. That sounded both crazy and corny, but by the time Dees began to get a picture of what had gone on in Duffery, he had actually begun to believe it. Which meant that part of the story would never see print, and not just because it was personal. It violated Dees's single ironclad rule: never believe what you publish and never publish what you believe. It had, over the years, allowed him to keep his sanity, while those all about him had been losing theirs. He had landed at Washington National, a real airport for a change, and rented a car to take him the 60 miles to Dufferin, because without Ray Sarch and his wife, Ellen, there was no Dufferin airfield. Aside from Ellen's sister, Raylene, who was a pretty fair socket wrench Susie, the two of them had been the whole shebang. There was a single oiled dirt runway, oiled both to lay the dust and to discourage the growth of weeds, and a control booth not much bigger than a closet attached to the jet air trailer where the Sarch couple lived. They were both retired, both flyers, both reputedly as tough as nails, and still crazy in love with each other even after almost 5 decades of marriage. Further, Dees learned, the Sarches watched the private air traffic in and out of their field with a close eye. They had a personal stake in the war on drugs. Their only son had died in the Florida Everglades, trying to land in what looked like a clear stretch of water with better than a ton of Acapulco gold packed into a stolen Beach 18. The water had been clear, except for a single stump, that was. The Beach 18 hit it, water looped, and exploded. Doug Sarch had been thrown clear, his body smoking and singed, but probably still alive, as little as his grieving parents would want to believe such a thing. He had been eaten by gators, and all that remained of him when the DEA guys finally found him a week later was a dismembered skeleton, a few maggoty scraps of flesh, a charred pair of Calvin Klein jeans, and a sport coat from Paul Stewart in New York. One of the sport coat pockets had contained better than $20,000 in cash. Another had yielded nearly an ounce of Peruvian flake cocaine. "It was drugs and the motherfuckers who run 'em killed my boy," Ray Sarch had said on several occasions, and Ellen Sarch was willing to double and redouble on that one. Her hatred of drugs and drug dealers, Dees was told again and again. He was amused by the nearly unanimous feeling in Dufferin that the murder of the elderly Sarches had been a gangland hit, was exceeded only by her grief and bewilderment over the seduction of her son by those very people. Following the death of their son, the Sarches had kept their eyes peeled for anything or anyone who looked even remotely like a drug transporter. They had brought the Maryland State Police out to the field 4 times on false alarms, but the state bears hadn't minded because the Sarches had also blown the whistle on 3 small transporters and 2 very big ones. The last had been carrying 30 pounds of pure Bolivian cocaine. That was the kind of bus that made you forget a few false alarms, the sort of bus that made promotions. So, very late in the evening of July 30th, comes this Cessna Skymaster, with a number and description that had gone out to every airfield and airport in America, including the one in Dufferin. A Cessna whose pilot had identified himself as Dwight Renfield, point of origination Bayshore Airport, Delaware, a field which had never heard of Renfield or a Skymaster with tail number N101BL. The plane of a man who was almost surely a murderer. "If he'd flown in here, he'd be in the stir now," one of the Bayshore controllers had told Dees over the phone. But Dees wondered. Yes. He wondered very much. The night flyer had landed in Dufferin at 11:27 p.m., and Dwight Renfield had not only signed the Sarches' logbook, but also had accepted Ray Sarches' invitation to come into the trailer, have a beer, and watch a rerun of Gunsmoke on TNT. Ellen Sarch had told all of this to the proprietor of the Dufferin Beauty Bar the following day. This woman, Salida McCammon, had identified herself to Dees as one of the late Ellen Sarch's closest friends. When Dees asked how Ellen had seemed, Salida had paused and then said, "Dreamy somehow. Like a high school girl with a crush, almost 70 years old or not. Her color was so high I thought it was makeup, until I started in on her perm. Then I saw that she was just, you know." Salida McCammon shrugged. She knew what she meant, but not how to say it. "Head up," Dees suggested, And that made Salida McCammon laugh and clap her hands. Head up! That's it. You're a writer, all right. Oh, I write like a boyd, Dees said, and offered a smile he hoped looked good-humored and warm. This was an expression he had once practiced almost constantly, and continued to practice with fair regularity in the bedroom mirror of the New York apartment he called his home, and in the mirrors of the hotels and motels that were really his home. It seemed to work, Salida McCammon answered it readily enough. But the truth was that Dees had never felt good-humored and warm in his life. As a kid, he had believed these emotions didn't really exist at all. They were just a masquerade, a social convention. Later on, he decided he had been wrong about that. Most of what he thought of as Reader's Digest emotions were real, at least for most people. Perhaps even love, the fabled big enchilada, was real. That he himself could not feel these emotions was undoubtedly a shame, but hardly the end of the world. There were, after all, people out there with cancer and AIDS, and the memory spans of brain-damaged parakeets. When you looked at it that way, you quickly realized that being deprived of a few huggy-kissy emotions was fairly small beans. The important thing was that if you could manage to stretch the muscles of your face in the right directions every now and then, you were fine. It didn't hurt, and it was easy. If you could remember to zip up your fly after you took a leak, you could remember to smile and look warm when it was expected of you. And an understanding smile, he had discovered over the years, was the world's best interview tool. Once in a while, a voice inside asked him what his own inside view was, but Dees didn't want an inside view. He only wanted to write and to take photographs. He was better at the writing, always had been and always would be, and he knew it. But he liked the photographs better, just the same. He liked to touch them, to see how they froze people, either with their real faces hung out for the whole world to see, or with their masks so clearly apparent that they were beyond denial. He liked how, in the best of them, people always looked surprised and horrified, how they looked caught. If pressed, he would have said, the photographs provided all the inside view he needed. And the subject had no relevance here anyway. What did was the night flyer, his little batty buddy, and how he had waltzed into the lives of Ray and Ellen Sarch a week or so earlier. The flyer had stepped out of his plane and walked into an office with a red-bordered FAA notice on the wall, a notice which suggested there was a dangerous guy out there driving a Cessna Skymaster 337, tail number N101BL, who might have murdered two men. This guy, the notice went on, might or might not be calling himself Dwight Renfield. The Skymaster had landed, Dwight Renfield had signed in, and had almost surely spent the following day in the belly hold of his plane. And what about the Sarches, those two sharp-eyed old folks? The Sarches had said nothing. The Sarches had done nothing. Except that the latter wasn't quite right, Dees had discovered. Ray Sarch had certainly done something. He had invited the night flyer in to watch an old Gunsmoke episode and drink a beer with his wife. They had treated him like an old friend. And then, the next day, Ellen Sarch had made an appointment at the beauty bar, which Salida McCammon had found surprising. Ellen's visits were usually as regular as clockwork, and this one was at least 2 weeks before Salida would next have expected her. Her instructions had been unusually explicit. She had wanted not just the usual cut, but a perm, and a little color, too. She wanted to look younger, Salida McCammon told Dees, and then wiped a tear from one cheek with the side of her hand. But Ellen Sarch's behavior had been pedestrian compared to that of her husband. He had called the FAA at Washington National and told them to issue a NOTAM, removing Duffery from the active airfield grid, at least for the time being. He had, in other words, pulled down the shades and closed up the shop. On his way home, he'd stopped for gas at the Duffery Texaco and told Norm Wilson, the proprietor, that he thought he was coming down with the flu. Norm told Deez that he thought Ray was probably right about that. He'd looked pale and wan, suddenly even older than his years. That night, the two vigilant fire wardens had, in effect, burned to death. Ray Sarch was found in the little control room, his head torn off and cast into the far corner, where it sat on a ragged stump of neck, staring toward the open doorway with wide, glazed eyes, as if there were actually something there to see. His wife had been found in the bedroom of the Sarch trailer. She was in bed. She was dressed in a peignoir so new it might never have been worn before that night. She was old, a deputy had told Deez. At $25, he was a more expensive fuck than Ezra the Amazing Ginhead Mechanic, but worth it. But you still only had to take one look to know that there was a woman who dressed for bed with loving on her mind. Deez had liked the C&W twang so much that he wrote it down in his notebook. Those huge, spike-sized holes were driven into her neck, one in the carotid, the other in the jugular. Her face was composed, her eyes closed, her hands on her bosom. Although she had lost almost every drop of blood in her body, there were only spots on the pillows beneath her, and a few more spots on the book which lay open on her stomach, The Vampire Lestat by Anne Rice. And the night flyer? Sometime just before midnight on July 31st, or just after it, on the morning of August 1st, he had simply flown away, like a boid, or a bat. Deez touched down in Wilmington 7 minutes before official sunset. While he was throttling back, still spitting blood out of his mouth from the cut below his eye, he saw lightning strike down with blue-white fire so intense that it nearly blinded him. On the heels of the